Very good. Okay, so the last class we started talking about the problem of gene recognition. And we talked about several features that arise basically discussed the basic problem of gene recognition as being somewhat ill-defined, because we don't completely know exactly how genes work. But we basically describe sort of two families of gene prediction programs, okay? One was, we described genes as being, again, having certain features that you could sort of recognize, okay? Genes were broken into introns and exons, and there were certain features like these donor and acceptor sites, these short patterns at the beginning and end of introns. We saw that genes had to correspond to open reading frames, basically coding regions without stop symbols in it. And so there were a bunch of weak signals that we had talked about for doing that genes had. And so to build a gene recognition program, we talked about one approach, which was to take all the features that we knew about genes, okay, try to write up some kind of a program that took them in mind and build an ad hoc kind of program based on the features we know should be in genes. Those are what I call the ad hoc type recognition programs. And they work reasonably well. We also talked about a class of prediction programs for genes based on homology searching, namely knowing that any gene is likely something that occurred in a database someplace. Okay, if genes will, genes represent proteins, important proteins are conserved across species. If you have done enough sequencing and enough annotation of previous gene sequences, then you will know that with high probability, eventually, any new sequence you have, the gene that you find there is going to have be homologous to some gene that you have already recognized. And so by doing sequence comparison, you can identify whether your gene is an existing gene. Okay, whether your new sequence contains a gene that is homologous to a known gene. So these are two classes of gene recognition programs. The first, based on sort of looking for weird features, is in principle good when we're looking for genes that are unlike anything we have seen before. Okay? The second is good when we're looking for genes that are similar to something we've already identified as a gene. So those are the two most obvious ways to do gene recognition. Any questions about that, or anyone want me to review what a gene is or anything like that? From last class. It's sort of clear, reasonable. Okay, what I'd like to do is to talk about a different way of doing gene recognition. Okay, actually, what is probably the most successful way to do gene recognition. Actually, would you like to turn out one of the lights? Maybe that might make it easier to see. People who know me know that I tend to be a highly suspicious person. Okay, that I tend to sort of break people into groups. Okay, that's right. That's right. One more light. The other one. People know that I tend to be a very suspicious person. I group the world into groups of people, some of whom I trust and some of whom I do not trust. Okay? And when something comes out of a group of people that I do not trust, I am highly suspicious and I'm usually right. Okay? But not always right. Okay? And one group of people who I tend to be suspicious of as an algorithms person are the AI people. Okay, AI means artificial intelligence. Okay, and I would tend to break the world of computer scientists into, or let's say computational biologists, sort of fall into two camps, okay, in general. I would say that there is the group that comes out of the algorithms community, which is what I would do, which is we tend to think of the world as existing of well-defined problems, and once you've defined the problem carefully, we'll give you an algorithm for it. Versus what I would call the pattern recognition or AI community. And they're not concerned so much about whether a problem is well defined. They are happy to try to solve it anyway. And the
out of the AI community has sort of emerged this technology of using things like hidden Markov models and neural networks to try to solve ill-defined problems. So let's try to think about what the difference would be. In a well-defined problem, we understand the problem, we analyze the problem, okay, and we think we know how to solve it, then we write a program based on what we're doing. Another approach would be what I would call a more data-intensive approach. I don't know how to analyze the problem. I don't know anything about the problem or the domain, but I have a bunch of examples, some of which are examples of the thing I want to find, some of which are examples of things I don't want to find. And maybe I can build a program that will look at my examples and learn from them somehow, and learn to recognize the thing that I'm trying to recognize, even if I can't really define it. Okay? And that is sort of the, what I would say, the pattern recognition approach to doing prediction. Okay? And so the basic idea behind the pattern recognition approach, at least I will call it, or the learning-based approach, would be that instead of building a prediction program where we identify features like, oh gee, open reading frames are important, okay, or codon bias is important, we have a program that somehow learns to recognize features that are interesting, okay, and, you know, works basically without necessarily knowing very much about the domain itself, okay? So one of the reasons why, for example, I would tend to be suspicious of these kind of people, okay, is that they build programs that will learn from data. When the stock market is going up, they'll say, great, I'm very good at analyzing stock market data. Okay, if you give me a bunch of time series of stock market data, some stocks going up, some stocks going down, I can predict what's a good stock to buy based on just analyzing that data. Or when computational biology is a hot field, you give me a bunch of data on what is a gene and what is not a gene, I'll take these same programs and try to make them work on that. Now, that said, this seems a little bit suspicious, but in fact, actually, these learning-based programs do work fairly well for gene recognition. And in fact, the best programs that are now exist for gene recognition are the ones that work on these learning-based models. So we have to give respect where respect is due. And the approach that we're going to be talking about mostly, again, sometimes you hear things called neural networks, sometimes you hear things called hidden Markov models. We're going to spend today and probably next class talking about hidden Markov models. Okay, and if you're interested in these things, this is probably the best book around for on hidden Markov models. It's this book for biological sequence analysis. Okay, so we're going to leave the Gusfield book and get into the Durbin book for at least the next couple of classes. Any questions? Okay, so let's look at, not for gene recognition, but let's look at an example that they have in this book, which I kind of like. Looking for analyzing a feature called the CG island. Okay, so when you look at sequence annotations, one set of features that people talk about, okay, or that they annotate that are considered biologically important, are things called CG islands. Okay? And a CG island, okay, is what I would think of it as being where the pair CG occurs, the pair of nucleotide CG occurs often. Okay? Now, why are they interesting, or why do they emerge? Okay? Well, there's a what I'll call biological process called methylation, where when you have DNA sequencing, a DNA molecule, okay, certain things called methyl groups get attached to it at certain places. Again, this is probably outside my domain. But basically, at portions of the sequence that are methylated, they are more likely to have a CG site mutate to a TG site. Okay? So if you have a region where there's a lot of CGs, okay, that is probably a place where, historically, this methylation has been suppressed, okay? This sort of biological activity didn't happen, okay? And so recognizing where there is a large concentration of CGs, okay, is a place where methylation was suppressed. There was probably a biological reason for that. You would like to identify regions of the genome where that occurs. Okay? So the process of recognizing CG islets, is the problem would be, as I would interpret it, given a DNA sequence, try to identify places where CGs are more plentiful than they should be. Okay? Anybody who knows anything want to comment about methylation and CG islets as to why that's important? Okay? I know we have a couple of biologists. I don't want to put anyone on the spot. Okay. I will accept that this is, I as a computer scientist am perfectly happy to accept that looking for regions of CGs is important. Okay? Yes? Yeah.
So we have one thing
that can form a Okay. I'll accept that. Okay? But what's interesting is now, how would we go about, if you were charged with writing a program to find regions of high CG concentration, how would you go about doing it? Okay? I, as an algorithms person, would go by and say, okay, CG group islands are defined by, you told me, a high concentration of CGs. You know, I might, break the sequence into small pieces and count the number of CGs in each piece. And, I would propose this as a well-defined problem. Overall sequences, what is the sequence with the highest number, highest ratio of CGs to it? Okay? And then I could maybe search all possibilities, or this is how I would start by thinking about it. Define what you mean by a CG island. How long does it have to be? Okay? How many CGs do you need? The densest CG island would be one that just was two bases long that had a CG. Okay? So I would have to factor length in here somehow. Okay? So somehow this seems like a problem that you could define in a well-defined algorithmic way, but you've got to be a little bit careful. For a feature to be interesting, it's not just that it has a high density of CGs. Maybe it has a high density of CGs over a long area or a short area. Okay? This is something that I would have to work out with my biologists if they really wanted a program for this. Okay? So the way I would do it as an algorithms person is by defining an algorithm, okay, a well-defined heuristic, okay, based on once you qualify, tell me what a CG island is. Now, the way that the example in the book does, okay, is instead to try to take biologists, have them annotate a bunch of DNA sequences, have them say, this looks to me like a CG island, okay? Oh, well, this sequence here, from here to here, is where I think the CG island is. And if you give me enough examples of it, I will then take a program and try to train it, okay, to recognize CG islands, okay? And so it basically works from annotated examples, okay, and tries to build something, okay? So the example we're now going to look at are the notions of Markov models and hidden Markov models to recognize these features, these so-called hidden CG islands. Okay? Any questions? So what do I mean by a Markov model? Okay, a Markov model, as I interpret it, a Markov chain, okay, is a probabilistic chain of events, okay, where the probability of going, if you think about it, a Markov chain is sort of, and if you're a computer scientist, I think of it as sort of as an automata, if you wish. It's a model where you've got a set of states. And you can transition from one state to another state according to a probability. Okay? And the thing that makes a Markov model a Markov model is that the probability of transition between a pair of states is independent of how you got to that state. Okay? But where you go from there. So for example, let me just draw a little, so let's take a look here at a picture like this. Here is a, let's just hide it like that. Here is a four vertex automata, one representing A, C, G, and T, one for each state. Okay? And each state here may represent What is the, what is the last base that you saw?
Okay.
And we can have edges going from any state to every other state, weighted by a particular probability.
Okay.
So if, let's say, we wanted to build an automata that somehow generated random sequences,
okay, where every sequence was equally likely,
we could think of an automata where, from every one of these letter sequences, there is a 1/4 probability of going from any state to any other state.
Okay?
And with that, we believe that the set of walks on this automata,
okay,
assuming you started in any state equal, you started in any particular state with equal probability. If you now walk 5 steps along that automata, the set of sequences that you would build would be all possible sequences of length 5, and they would all be equally likely.
Okay?
So in a Markov model like this, again, we have states representing somehow, you know, how, what we know about our situation. Like in this case, our last character was an A.
Okay?
And we will jump to other states according to probabilities. That is what we mean by a Markov model.
Okay?
And we can agree that by biasing, by, if we have non-uniform edge probabilities, the probability of generating any particular string from this is going to be different. If all these edge probabilities are uniform, we generate all DNA sequences equally likely.
Okay?
If, on the other hand, let's say that the probability we transition from A to C was 0, okay, and the other edges from A to all the other letters was 1, was, you know, there should be self-loops here, it was a state from A to A was 1/3, 1/3, 1/3, we would generate all sequences that did not contain AC.
Okay?
So by adjusting these probabilities, we can bias what sequences we generate.
Okay? And that should be pretty obvious. Any questions? Okay?
So, so a Markov model is, again, one of these networks of states where, as far as we're concerned, the probability of being in a state S at a time T is going to be completely a function of, first of all, the probability that we were in every state at a previous time, and the state transition function, giving the probability it took to get from the other states to our given state.
Okay?
So Markov models, so each step is somehow independent of its previous history.
Okay?
We don't care how we got to all those previous states. If we know the probability of being in all the other states at time t minus 1, and we know the probability of going from all those states to S, we know what the probability of us being at state S is at time t.
This is a Markov process. Any questions about that? Okay, good.
So, what can we now do with this? Okay? If, okay? If we now think of one of these Markov processes, okay? We can now figure out what is the probability that we
got to a particular state.
Suppose I have a automata where I have states representing different characters, A, C, T, and G, and edges going from left to right to subsequent stages. Okay? What is the probability that I end up at this state over here? Okay? It is a function of the probability of all the states that led into me. It's the probability of the weights of these edges times the probability I got to those states.
Okay?
And the probability I got to these states,
okay,
is a function of the probability that was in their predecessor states. Okay, and the edges into this.
So what I would like to say is, it should be clear that given a model like this, I can compute the probability that I end up in any particular state, okay, based off, okay, I can compute the probability of any other particular state based on my knowledge of any of the previous states. The probability I follow any particular path, okay, is the result of multiplying the probability of the edges I encounter on that path. Okay? I guess I've said this in a funny way, but that should be, I think, pretty clear. Okay?
Now, when you read, so we're going to be interested in computing probabilities across these automata. In the literature of these hidden Markov models, you'll be reading a lot not about multiplying probabilities, but about summing up logarithms of probabilities. And the reason for this is that if you're multiplying numbers together, okay, the product you get by multiplying numbers together is conceptually the same as the anti-log of the sum of the logarithms. This is, I think, also...
Again, this is trivial. I'm sorry, I'm getting pumped from you. A times B, we know that A times B, the log of A times B, is the same as the log of A plus the log of B. Okay? So if you're going to be computing probabilities of a long chain of events that are very rare, you could do it by multiplying a lot of probabilities. But the problem is that probabilities are small numbers between zeros and ones. Multiplying a lot of small numbers gives you a very small number. Okay? And so historically, for analyzing these things, it is conceptually easier to think about summing logarithms rather than multiplying numbers. Okay? This again should be obvious and maybe not that exciting. Okay? But we're going to be interested in what is the probability that any genome sequence exists, occurs according to a model? And since genome sequences will be, you know, let's say a sequence of 100, the probability that in a uniform model where every base occurred equally likely, the probability any one model occurred is 1/4 of 100. It's a vanishingly small number. So summing logarithms is sort of conceptually a better thing to do than multiplying probabilities. Okay?
Any questions? Now, so how might we recognize CG islands using Markov models? Suppose, let's say that I am given a bunch of examples of things that are CG islands, and then given a bunch of examples of things that are not CG islands. How can I now use that to build some kind of a program to recognize whether an unknown sequence is a CG island? One possibility is to take all the sequences that are CG islands and compute the probability of transition between every pair of bases, okay, and all the things that you say are CG islands, okay, and all the things that you say are not CG islands, I compute the probability of transition, okay. I build a separate island here, a separate automata, where the probabilities here are not, are the transition between bases in the negative examples. How might I use those automata to try to distinguish if an unknown sequence is a CG island or not? Okay? Any ideas? Okay, yes. Right, so one thing let's do is now, as we said before, if you give me a new sequence, okay, I can take any one of these automata and compute what is the probability that that sequence was generated by this automata. namely by multiplying the states, the probabilities of the state transitions, or equivalently, summing up the logarithms of those state transitions. Okay? If I had two alternate models, okay, I could find, I take my input sequence, okay, I run it through this model, multiply the probability of transition through that, get a score, run it through the negative model, get the probability through that, the probability that that sequence was generated in the negative one. I could then decide CG Island or not CG Island based on which orthogonal gave me the higher score. Okay? And that would give me a way to, based on learning, to simply looking at the probabilities, the learning the values of these transitions from my test data, it would give me a way to decide CG Island or not. Okay? Based on that. Any questions? Okay? Now, in the example they give in the book that I think is kind of interesting, in their examples of things distinguishing between, you know, we said CG Islands were places where there were a lot of CGs relative to other sequences. In their negative examples, they had a 0.78 probability of going from C to G, okay? Meaning that CGs were rare, they only occurred 7% of the time of the transitions from C. Whereas the CG transition occurred 27% of the time within the islands. Okay? So it's clear that with a feature like that, the higher the probability of the sequence, essentially what that's going to reflect is a larger number of transitions from C to T. Okay? Any questions? Okay? So one way to sort of do sequence classification would be to build separate automata based on positive examples and separate automata based on negative examples. Run the sequence through both and identify what the winner is. What might be a limitation of an approach like that? Okay? Why might that not be a good thing to do? Because of the same thing conceptually for gene recognition. What would be, if I give you an unknown sequence, okay, and I ask you whether it's a gene or not, okay, I could conceivably train one automata based on genes and one automata based on things that are not genes. And now I give you an input sequence. Okay? What might be a limitation of this kind of an approach? Yeah? What? Okay, so one thing that you're saying is that it has no memory, that a simple automata like this with only four states.
Yeah, I mean, you know, remember that this is a scan state, and we got
ATG. Okay, so you're saying that the automata couldn't remember that it had a lot of a chain of ATs. Okay? Okay, so there are a couple of different issues here. One issue is a question of the number of states in your automata. Okay, and here we have a model that is only four states long. Okay, so you can't remember anything except the previous character in some sense.
You can remember states by assigning fewer.
Right, so another thing, so that by itself is not really a limitation of this kind of an approach. We could, let's say that we find that genes, the interesting features in genes occur within a range of 10 bases. Okay?
We could build an automata something like what I did here, where we have states representing windows. Okay? The state automata arranged in layers. And on each character, we transition to a state in the next layer. By doing this, in some sense, we could now remember in the automata, in some sense, a history of the last 10 characters. Okay, or at least use sort of a notion that, you know, recognize more complicated models, try to represent patterns that are, we know, are not based on adjacent bases, but based on longer windows. Okay? So that by itself is not necessarily a limitation of this idea of using two automata.
one for positive examples and one for negative examples. Okay? Are there, yes? Say that again? Okay, so it's clear that a learning technique is going to have trouble if you're trying to recognize something that is completely different from anything you've ever seen before. Okay? So it's clear that to a certain extent how good a learning, the result of a learning program can be depends upon how representative your test set or training data is. Okay? And that's something that it's clear we've got to live with. But in the case of gene recognition, maybe you can build a good test case. Okay? Is there any limitation that we can think of, though, of keeping two different automata, one for positive and one for negative examples? Yeah.
If the scores are really close,
so one possibility is that you might not, it might not do it, you know, it might be the case the probability of this is 10 times, 10 to the minus 100th in one automata, and this is 10 to the minus 100th plus 1 in another automata. So it could be that the probabilities that you get for any input sequence might be so close that you can't make a good guess. But that's not by itself a limitation of the idea of having separate automata. You know, you could sort of say that, you know, if the difference in the probabilities between the two automata is very, very close, okay, then, you know, we will just say it's too close to call. We'll say that anything that scores much better in this is a gene, anything that scores much better in this is not a gene, and anything else we don't know. Okay? So all of the objections we've had so far really are not a problem with having multiple automata, let's say two automata, one for identifying yes, one for identifying no, and viewing these as sort of decoupled systems. Yes? What if it's both yes and no? Okay? If you think about our problem, we're getting an input, a DNA sequence. Okay? We don't know for sure if this is a gene, not a gene, or if it has a gene as part of it. Okay? You think about it, you sequence 2,000 bases, or 20,000 bases, or 100,000 bases. You want to identify whether or not there's a gene in here. If the feature you're looking for is perhaps small relative to the size of the window, anything that assigns a score based on a global property, or a global score, yes or no, can't work to answer questions of does this thing contain a smaller structure? Okay, does everybody sort of see that? Okay. Yeah. So what you're saying here is, you're saying that maybe what we can do is view decoupled. So what possibility you might be saying is we could, let's say, divide the sequence into smaller pieces. Okay, that's not quite what you're saying, but I'm just saying the idea that you might be saying is you could divide the sequence into smaller pieces, okay, and maybe run the two models on this smaller piece, okay, and say, well, which score is better here? Okay, and divide it into smaller chunks and say, which piece scores better there? Somehow we need a principled way to combine the two different models, the yes model and the no model, to make one decision that will change over the course of the over the course of the sequence. Okay? You might come up with ad hoc ways to do it. Okay? But the idea of a hidden Markov model, okay, is that it provides a way to enable us to, in some sense, switch back and forth our predictions. between whether something, you know, in a world where we have an input stream that is, some of it is yes and some of it is no. Okay? We're going to now try to train an automata with the property that it will help us learn whether we're in or not in, okay, you know, a particular feature. Okay? Any questions? So what I guess what I'm trying to say, that maybe I'm not saying very clear, is that this model, this idea of building a single model based on probabilities from positive examples and a single model from negative examples is a perfectly reasonable idea that, having said, all of you could go off and program in some sense. Okay? The problem is that that we would like to find a way to collapse them into one model, okay, so that we can recognize hidden features, okay, switch back and forth between them. And so the models that are built by basically building these little Markov state automata, okay, where we're going to have multiple states hidden in the automata, people call hidden Markov models, okay? So they ask, what is hidden? Okay, the meaning of the state, okay, the actual state the model is in, is hidden, okay, in a hidden Markov model. Whereas in the regular Markov model, somehow all the states have the same meaning. That may not be a good definition, but that's what people mean. So let's look at a single way that we might automata that we might be able to build that could recognize both regions that are CG islands and regions that are not CG islands. Suppose we build one automata where four of the states are recognized as positive states, four of the states are recognized as negative states, and we have edges that not only travel within each model from positive state to positive state and negative state to negative state, we also allow transitions from positive states to negative states, and vice versa. Now, we can build a model such that for any particular sequence, it might start off in a positive state, rattle around for a while, then follow an edge that goes down here, okay, into the negative model, okay, and vice versa, okay? Any questions? Yes. Well, now if you look at this thing, what was the question is, how do we determine the probabilities? Well, first of all, there are a couple different things you might be asking. First thing to note is that this automata now is so we have to figure out the probability of jumping from positive to negative. Okay? And that is something that you have to figure out what those probabilities are. The other thing to note, though, is that this is a non-deterministic automata. If you're in this state, on an A, you could either stay or in the positive state. On certain A's, you will have to stay in the positive state. On certain A's, you're going to jump into a negative state A. Okay? So the first thing to see here is that under this kind of a combined model, we no longer have a deterministic automata. We now have a non-deterministic automata. Okay? There is no longer a unique branch to go from. Okay? Does everybody sort of see that? That in interpreting a DNA sequence, it's going to rattle around the positive states until there is a transition. But there's a positive state for every letter and a negative state for every letter. Okay? So somehow we've got to make the decision what is the right way to go. Okay? How might we make that decision? Okay? Let's say you wanted to, and I'll give you an input DNA sequence. Okay? If I give you a model where you've got transitions within positive states, within negative states, and across these states, how now would I interpret the probability of an input DNA sequence? Okay? What would I do on a chart? Yes. Okay? It's clear that now, since it's not deterministic, What I really want to try to find is what is the path through this automata that maximizes the probability for any given sequence. Right? Okay? Does that mean I always follow the edge of highest probability? Okay? Not necessarily. Okay? It could be, as you would expect in something like this. It is probably fairly rare you jump from a CG island to a non-CG island. But if we imagine a world where
sequences are, consist of a few CG islands in a longer sequence, it's clear that the proper interpretation is we switch occasionally from one mode to another, okay, only when the benefit is large, okay? So you would imagine a world where the probability of transitioning across modes is relatively small. But if the interpretation for a large chunk of subsequent sequence is better in that mode, the global probability will be higher. So the probability of interpreting what a sequence is in a model like this is that of finding the highest probability path through the model. Okay? Does everybody sort of agree with that? Okay? That one way to interpret now a sequence is we start our sequence, run it through the model, find the highest probability path. When that highest probability path takes us in positive states, we say we are in a CG model island. When it takes us through negative states, we say we're not in a CG island. Okay? And this enables us to annotate features within it. Okay? Any questions? So the idea of the hidden Markov model really now rests on two different problems we have to solve that we haven't described yet. One, how do we find the highest probability path through the model? And two, how do we train these weights? Okay? It was, I think, yes. Okay, where it ends up is not what I'm concerned with here. The question is, where does it actually visit? Suppose, let's say that I have this automata. Any particular sequence is going to be described by, any particular path through this automata. Let's think of it this way. Any path through the automata describes a sequence. Do you believe that? Okay, it's not true that any sequence describes a path. Why is that? Because there's now non-determinism here. Okay, if I give you the sequence ACT, it could be ACT, it could be ACT, it could be ACT. But every path through this automata describes a sequence, right? Because the states are labeled with characters. If I find the path through this automata which has the highest probability for my sequence, I can now take a look at that path. Whenever I'm on the top half of my drawing, I say that, yes, you're in an island. Whenever I'm in the bottom half of the automata, I say, no, you're not in an island. So once I find a path associated with my input sequence, the interpretation of that path falls naturally, depending upon whether, which parts are in the positive part and which are in the negative part. Okay? Any questions about that? Yes? Well, in this particular model, okay, I will claim that the question of whether I stay in this model, as I've described it here, does not say anything about length. It does not say that it's good to be in a positive state for a long time, certainly not explicitly.
It doesn't say that CG islands have to be long. But if the probabilities of transitioning across the sort from one model to the other are very, very low, that de facto makes it expensive to go from one model to the other, and will make you want to hang around in one model a long time in order to make it desirable. Okay? So if, let's say it's expensive to transition from one state to another. If I just have one CG, it's not going to be worth it my time to jump into the positive state for one CG if I take a hit going there and a hit coming back. Okay? So that kind of feature is not explicitly modeled in this, but it somehow falls out of the weights that you get assigned. It falls out of the training data. If in fact I learn that CG islands are long, that would mean that the probability of transition is probably very, across models, is very, very low. And that should fall out of my training data. Okay? Any other questions? Question? So the question is, would it make the model better if instead of having a four-state model for CGs, maybe what I could do is have an eight-state model where I have each state represents the last two symbols that I saw, right? I have a 16-state model, okay? So it could be that I have an AA state, an AD state, an AG state. Would that be a better predictor of CG islands if I had more states in that model? Well, it depends. Why might it be a better model? Okay, it might be a better model if, in fact, CG islands contain features that are only that involve those more complicated patterns. Okay, if knowing that, in fact, in a CG island, the CGs are always followed by A's. If they were really, a CGA island, that no biologist ever saw that before. Then having an orthometer where there were more states up here to encode more information might be much better. Why might it be worse to have a more complicated model? Okay? Anybody think of reasons why having more states might actually make the model worse? Yeah? Well, increase what computation time? Let's first think about what computation time you mean. You mean for actually running my model through the, recognizing the gene? Okay? Not really. It turns out that the algorithm for test for finding the highest probability state is fairly efficient. So adding more states isn't going to make it that much more time consuming to recognize whether a particular gene is, whether a particular sequence is in this part or that part. The biggest problem that comes in from having a lot more states is you've got a lot more parameters that you now have to estimate. Okay? If you think about it, what is making this automata go is that you've got these edge links. Okay? And the term training the automata is that of computing what is the, of estimating from the observed data what is the probability of each one of these transitions. The more complicated a model you have, the more parameters you have, okay? And the more parameters you have, the more data you need, first of all, to be able to set it appropriately, okay? And to make sure that it has any meaning. How many parameters does this simple model have? This model looks very simple, but how many parameters does it have? Okay? What? 60? 16? Well, it's got, I'm trying to figure out if I believe that. That is, if I now look at it, I have 8 vertices. Okay? It would be, every pair is adjacent to every other pair. Okay? If we assume a directional model, where, you know, the link from A to B is different than the link from B to, you know, from B. Basically, it's going to be something like 56 different links here. Okay? So you've got a large number of parameters, even in a very, very simple model like this. And so the trade-off that you get is the number of states, the more parameters. Yes? The reason why there's no error from A to A is because I didn't draw it. It should be one there. Okay? So, but realize that there are a lot of parameters here. And it's sort of like solving a curve-fitting model. If you want to think of, let's say, why these orthogonal might be dangerous the bigger you make them, is that if you allow a lot of these transitions here, you quickly get a lot of different parameters you have to learn. Okay? And each one of these parameters, if you wish, should be supported by your training set. Okay? And so the art in designing these kind of things is you want to build an automata that, the simplest automata, in terms of the smallest number of parameters, that captures the interesting features of your situation. Okay? And at the moment you allow transitions from any state to any other state, the number of parameters you need is going to grow quadratically with the number of states. Okay? Any questions here? Yes? So it's clear that if you want to recognize genes, this is a hopelessly simple automata to try to recognize genes, right? Because, you know, genes are complicated things. So it's certainly the case that we would not want to recognize, we would need a more complicated automata to recognize genes than the CG islands. Okay? But the art that we're going to have to be aware of is we want to try to design an automata which has small numbers of states, small numbers of parameters, and yet captures the interesting biology. Okay? So there are a couple of different issues that we have in designing these models. One is, how do we find the most probable path through them? Another is, how do we train them? Okay? How do we set what those parameters are? And the third is, how do we design topologies? What is the graph or the set of states that we would want that would be most interesting to our model? These are the things we can play with, okay, and then we have to understand in order to build predictors using this technology. Any questions about that? Yes? So, in the model that we're going to be looking at, we're going to be assuming the world where you, the designer, this figures out the topology of your graph based on your knowledge of the application. You will then run it, take your input data and the topology of your model and run it through a training algorithm that is going to figure out what are the edge weights that are best used for that. And then you, the user of the final model, are going to take this input, a model with the edge weights that came from the learning thing, and a new sequence, and identify what the most probable path through that model is for this new sequence. Okay, we're not going to assume that the model adapts to what we see now. We're assuming a separate training phase and a separate using phase. Okay? Any questions? Okay? Very good. So let's look at the first algorithmic problem, okay? How do we find the optimal path through an automata? Suppose, let's say I give you the, one other thing. This is before I wanted to go through this thing. What might be an advantage? We talked about these Markov models as being, we've got these edge weights that we get from learning them. Okay, and we saw that in the example here, on learning, training on these CG islands, in the example they described, the probability of CG transitions in negative examples was much lower than in positive examples. What might be a reason why this kind of a model might do better than an ad hoc based model, than a model I built, saying just show me where there are a lot of CGs? Okay? What might be some other benefits that would come from training a model on input data rather than just me coming up with an idea that a CG island is a long sequence with a lot of CGs in it. Okay? Is there any other possible benefit of this? Well, what is, in fact, in CG islands is other features that the biologist forgot to tell me about. Not only are CGs, are there more CGs, maybe there are less ATs than there should be. Okay? So it may very well be that the actual prediction of whether something is a CG island is not going to depend only on the number of CGs. Okay? Quite often, again, the feature that they're asking us to predict is a somewhat mysterious thing. Okay, and there may be hidden assumptions and things like that. So, in fact, if we train on the test data, it may very well be that our assumptions were wrong, okay, about what we were really looking for. Okay, and the features that become interesting, okay, become apparent only when you build the classifier. Any questions? Okay. Of course, that's also potentially a problem. Sometimes that after you train a model like this, the model might be making decisions based on things that that you didn't really want it to make a model on. One system I once heard of that worked in a similar way analyzed training data for images to try to identify the difference between cars and trucks. And they trained it on a bunch of images of cars, they trained it on a bunch of images of trucks, and on their training set they did very, very well at distinguishing cars from trucks. When they put it in the field, they found that it did not work at all. And the reason when they analyzed it later was that the pictures of the cars were taken on sunny days. Okay, and the trucks were taken on cloudy days. And that in fact the links that were making the classification were based more heavily on features that were things that they didn't think they should have been basing it on than they should. So the bottom line is that you have a well-defined training set. Okay, you don't know what the features are, but your training set is good. Okay? Hopefully it can find other features that are meaningful to you that you might not know about. Okay? But hopefully you won't be fooled by things, artifacts such as that. Any questions? Okay. So let's look at the two algorithmic problems that come up in these automata. First question is, how do we go and identify the most probable path? And second is, how do we train, how do we set these edge parameters? Okay? Any questions so far? Okay. So how do we find the optimal path through a hidden Markov model? Well, the way I think of a hidden Markov model, I think of it as a non-deterministic automata, okay, where for any particular spring, there might be an exponential number of paths through it that are consistent with that spring. So any algorithm that works by try all possible paths for my automata, for my input spring, is doomed to failure. Does everybody sort of agree with that? Okay, on the particular model I showed you before, there was a positive state and a negative state. Any sequence could either stay in the negative state or go to the positive state at any given point. There were 2 to the n possible interpretations, paths, for any sequence of length n. So explicitly tracing all of them is doomed to an exponential time algorithm. However, we can use dynamic programming to come up with a more efficient algorithm, an algorithm that would run in n times m squared time to determine the most probable path of an n element an n character spring through an automata with m states. Okay? How is this algorithm going to work? Well, what we really want to know is, if we think about this as an automata, the probability that the ith character of my spring ends up in this particular state is a function of what? What is the probability that the ith character of my spring ends up in this state? Yeah?
Product of the probability that all its predecessors during the
It depends upon what is the probability. If I know what the probability is that I will end up in every state on the I after I minus one characters, and I know the transition from every state to my new state, I claim I can compute the probability that I will end up on that state just from this. Does everybody sort of agree? The probability that I end up in this state, okay, as the ice character of my string, depends upon what it, for every, the ice character, some of the transitions to this state are going to represent the ice character. Remember, each transition is associated with a character. If the ice character of my sequence is an A, there may be multiple edges of labeled A going to this state. For all of them, if I know the probability of being in that state, the probability of me being in this state on an A is going to be the probability of I was on that predecessor state times the probability of following that link out from here. Okay? And summing that up will give me the probability that I will end up in this state. Okay? So what I'm going to do is, in order to figure out the most probable path through this, I am basically going to build a dynamic programming table of n times m cells, where n is the length of the string and m is the number of states. Okay? And the value of the ij cell is what is the probability that after the first I characters, I'm ending up in this state. Okay? Any questions about what my table is? Is that so? How many people sort of understand what my table is? Okay? Any questions? Any people don't understand? Okay, a couple people. Okay?
So what I'm going to do is build a dynamic programming table like before, where here are my states, and this axis is my sequence position. The values of the ij cell is going to be what is the probability that I am after the I character in the j state. And this, we agree, is going to depend on the probabilities of all the states for which there is a transition such that the I character is this.
Okay?
And if there is that transition. How many cells are there in my matrix? N times M. How much time does it take to update any one of these cells? Okay, in the worst case,
yes.
N times. Why? Because this probability might depend, let's say all the states had the, were legal to go into. Okay? All these states had the same letter transition. Okay? Conceivably, this probability depends on at most n previous states. Okay? And so I have n times m cells.
To update it takes m time. In n times m squared time, I can find the probability of me being in any state.
The most probable interpretation of the string can now be found by thinking which of these last states has the highest probability. And then walking backwards through this dynamic programming matrix, the way we walk backwards through the dynamic programming matrix that we saw in homology search. Any questions about that? Okay, it's really sort of the same kind of a thing. Now, you hear this thing, I call this algorithm for figuring out the most probable state dynamic programming. It seems simple enough, it doesn't really deserve a name. And yet you often hear it described as the Viterbi algorithm. Viterbi is, I think, a person, okay, who developed this. Okay? So when you hear people mumbling Viterbi algorithm, what you're really talking about is a dynamic programming kind of a problem. Okay, finding the most probable path through an automata. Okay? Now, this kind of a model of using these automata, note that this has nothing to do with biology in particular. We could have used this to determine One application of this kind of an algorithm is in speech recognition. Right? You're trying to figure out, if you hear garbled stuff coming out of a microphone, you bring it into sounds or phonemes. Okay? Maybe you're trying to represent what is the text that's associated with it. Okay? The possible character positions and everything will be a letter A through Z. Based on what kind of a sound you make, there'd be a probability to go from one state to another. Interpreting the sequence, what was said, would be just tracing the most probable path. Okay, so these models were originally developed from things like speech processing and things like that. Okay, and it's only later that they got interpreted to biology. Any questions? Okay, so we have solved the first algorithmic problem, which is how do we find the most probable path? Okay, any questions? Okay. The second algorithmic problem is how do we determine the probabilities of transition? Okay? And there are a couple different ways you can do this. If we think of our simple CG Island program, if our biologist gave us regions that were annotated by, he gave us a bunch of sequences, 100 sequences, and said, look, in these 100 sequences, the CG Islands, in this sequence, the CG Islands are here. In this sequence, the CG Islands are here. If we have a well-annotated thing and a simple automata model like this, one way to set those parameters would be based simply on our observations. If we understand this model, it should be fairly simple to compute what those probabilities are, right? Because in these particular framing examples, we know when we are in a CG island, we can compute what is the probability that, we know from any character that stays within a CG island, what is the probability that we were, stayed within it. When we were outside of it, we could look at all the sequences outside of it. What were the, transitions outside of it? We know, based on our annotated data, how many times did we jump back and forth? Okay? And based on that, we can now figure out, gee, 1 out of every 100 times I was in an A, I jumped into the CG island. Okay? So, one way that I could set these parameters is on an ad hoc basis, based on my understanding of the automata. Okay? And that would be how I would naturally think about doing it, based on training examples in a simple automata like this. But more generally, we would like to write a program that learns, without knowing sort of what the meaning of these things is, we'll figure out what those automata, those probabilities are. So, the way that these algorithms, the learning algorithms for HMMs work, tends to be what I will call iterative kind of an algorithm. Where you take as input an initial model, your topology is fixed, your weights are either all set to random values or some initial guesses, and that the standard training algorithms are now going to adjust the weights, okay, of the automata based on what we have seen. Okay? So how, let's try this as a thought process. Suppose I give you this automata. Suppose we set some initial weights to this thing. Can you think of a way or a criteria how I might adjust those weights in the basis of sequences that I see? Okay? Suppose you now give me training examples. How can I adjust those weights in response to those training examples? Okay? Any ideas?
Based on the initial guess,
Okay, I'm not completely sure I understood what you're saying. But one idea, the idea that I think is the sort of the natural idea, is somehow I'm going to take my annotated sequence. The annotated sequence tells me what is and what is not a CG island. I know that if my automata weights are good, then I should be rattling around here outside the island. Jump up here when I do go in the island, and jump out back when I get out of the island. What might I do for a particular training example? One thing I could do is use the current automata to try to predict for a known sequence what parts of it are CGs and what parts of it are not CGs. What are parts are positive, what parts are negative. Where the automata makes a decision that is different than my annotation. Suppose it tries to jump in here, when in fact it should be staying down here. A natural thing to do would be to say, well, maybe what I should do is lower the probability here and raise the probability of going to the corresponding state. So the natural idea of training these kind of an automata, okay, would be you set initial weights to it. For a training set, you go find the most probable path through it according to the current thing. Analyze where that annotation differs from the real one, and try to bump up the edges in such a way, such that it makes it more probable that next time I would bring this up, that if I gave this sequence next time, it would be more probable that I go through the right state. Okay? Does everybody think that seems like a basically plausible technique for doing this? Okay? Okay, so the iterative methods work by refining the edge weights. Okay? And there are a couple of... So the basic idea is that each training instance is run through the model and the weights adjusted to increase the probability that the training examples are correctly classified. Okay? So there are a couple of different algorithms that are used. Okay, some of you people talk about the Baum-Welsh algorithm or the Viterbi algorithm. Okay, in the Viterbi algorithm, what we will do is we will reinforce only the strong. We will find what is the strongest path for a particular input sequence. Okay, and then reinforce the weights so that one does better. The Baum-Welsh algorithm is a more general thing that calculates the probabilities of each forward and backward probabilities for each state and adjusts them. Yes? Well, if you only increase some of the probabilities and don't decrease the other ones, you stop having probabilities. Remember, probabilities are numbers between 0 and 1. Okay? If you have, from any state, a collection of, from here, I can, on an A, only stay here or go there. Increasing the probability I stay within this mode is equivalent, requires me to decrease all my other transitions. Okay? So you've got to do that kind of adjustment here in order to do it. Okay? Yes? Well, the question is, do you decrease them all the same amount or not? Now you're talking about a fuzzier area. What should your training algorithm do? Okay, and this is unless you specify a criteria for which the automata is going to satisfy afterwards, it's sort of an ill-defined question that you're asking. Okay? I think on an intuitive basis, it makes sense that we want to reinforce the path that's to make the automata do better on our training examples than it did before. Okay? And certainly it's a heuristic ad hoc thing. Bumping up appropriate edges to make that more likely is a natural thing to do. Okay? Now, there are several different automata training algorithms, okay, that you can use. Some are faster. How quickly does it sort of converge to a settling state? Some might be better, okay? But it's a little, unless you specify a condition under which the, that you're trying to optimize, it's not clear which one is right. Is that sort of clear? Okay? But basically there are these training algorithms that, if you think about them as black boxes, basically adjust the weights in response to what we're seeing. Okay? And they basically work by reinforcing tasks that we see on these automata. Any questions? Okay? So the basic scheme of HMMs should probably, should now sort of be clear, I think. Okay? We have to define a graph, define the edges that are allowed to, they represent legal transitions. We will adjust the weights of these edges based on what we've seen, using some kind of a training algorithm, be it ad hoc or be it something, an iterative algorithm like we talked about before. Okay? And then for any particular sequence, we will now find the most probable state based on that. Okay? And the most probable path, and that will enable us to annotate the sequence into good or bad regions. Any questions? Okay? So that should be the basic framework. Next class, we're going to look a little bit more at some of the other issues on these hidden Markov models and how they apply to gene recognition. Any questions? Questions? Are they undoing the memoryless property of a Markov model? Well, in every case, the memoryless property is still that all that we know is the probability of being in any one state is a function of only the probability that it was in the previous state that it was in.
But by adjusting the topology of the graph, you can encode a certain amount of memory. And that is actually a desirable thing to do. Okay? But notice that even in this case, for this particular state, the probability I make this transition is independent of how I got to this state. Okay? I may have gotten this way, I may have gotten this way. The memoryless property is saying that the probability I go from here to here is independent of how I got to here. Okay? Any questions?
Okay, thanks for your attention. We'll talk more about this next class.